Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Professor Ken Hinchcliffe, Warden of Trinity College. I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to the third in a series of lectures by the Colleges and Universities of the Anglican Communion. It's a pleasure to welcome members of the QAC Board and delegates from fellow colleges to Trinity College, and also to welcome other guests and students of the college to tonight's address by Mr. Kevin Rudd. Importantly, we meet tonight on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The Wurundjeri are descendants of the first peoples to inhabit this land and have been its custodians for over 40,000 years. Our acknowledgement of country, in which we honour Indigenous elders and past and present of this, the world's oldest civilisation, has an added relevance tonight. As Prime Minister, Mr. Rudd, on the 13th of February 2008, more than 10 years after the Bringing Them Home report was finalised, tabled a motion in the Federal Parliament apologising to Australia's Indigenous peoples, particularly the Stolen Generations and their families and communities, for laws and practices which had inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these, our fellow Australians. This apology was a landmark event in Australia's reconciliation with our Indigenous citizens, and our college is one of the many educational organisations across Australia who accepted the continuing challenge expressed so clearly by our Prime Minister that day. Tonight, our Master of Ceremonies is the Right Reverend Martin Wharton. Martin recently retired as the Bishop of Newcastle in the United Kingdom and has been a member of the Board of QAC for at least 20 years. He is passionately committed to the flourishing of Anglican colleges and universities around the world. Please welcome Bishop Martin as your MC for this evening's event. Thank you.
It is a very great pleasure for me to chair this annual lecture as a member of the QAC Board of Trustees. And as many of you will know, QAC exists as an international network of Anglican universities and colleges from all across the world. And it's a great privilege for me to introduce the Honourable Kevin Rudd as this year's Rowan Williams Lecturer. Kevin is so well known to all of you that he hardly requires any introduction at all. But when you consider all his achievements, you'll see why he's been chosen to give our lecture this year. Kevin was born and brought up in Queensland, first class degree in Asian studies, majoring in Chinese language and Chinese history, an alumnus of Bergman College in Canberra, one of the Anglican colleges with an Anglican foundation, and a valued part of the QAC family. At Bergman, Kevin made perhaps the most important discovery of his life, and he duly married Teresa there in 1981. The day after their marriage, they flew to Stockholm, where Kevin was working in the Australian Embassy, and then after a year or two there, on they went to a posting in Beijing. So through most of the 1980s, Kevin's career was that of an international diplomat. Returning to Australia in 1988 as Chief of Staff to the Labour leader in Queensland, and then Director of the Cabinet Office, where he drove through some major reforms in education. He entered the Federal Parliament in the 1990s, joined the Shadow Cabinet in 2001, with responsibility, fittingly, for foreign affairs, international security and trade. He became leader of the Labour opposition in 2006 and took the Labour Party to a historic victory in the 2007 election. Kevin was the 26th Prime Minister of Australia and was named by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world in 2008. And whatever you might think of Time magazine, that is a great accolade to be given. Kevin, amongst other things, was a member of a high-level United Nations panel on global sustainability from 2010 to 12, And he joined the Asia Society Policy Institute in January this year as its inaugural president. On any account, Kevin's career in diplomacy, in international relations, in politics and academia has been a highly significant and a highly influential one. Kevin's now based in New York, as is Kuak, where he's been a senior fellow at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. So the major themes of Kevin's life have so far included commitments to developing education, to developing international relations and reconciliation, and, of course, to sustainable development. All themes which lie at the heart of Kuak and at the heart of the Kuak colleges and universities. And so tonight's lecture, entitled Faith, Ethics and Climate Change, couldn't be more apposite and couldn't be more important and couldn't be more crucial for us all. So Kevin, we welcome you most warmly and thank you for accepting this invitation to give the lecture.
Thank you very much, Bishop, and thank you, Warden. And distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, God bother us one and all. I begin by honouring the first Australians on whose land we meet and whose cultures we celebrate as the oldest continuing cultures in human history. I thank Trinity College for their kind invitation to be here this evening, University of Melbourne, on whose grounds, I think, we hold our event this evening. Perhaps that's a difficult question of the originating covenants of the University of Melbourne. I'll leave that to you folks to resolve. And for those who have come to join us from Bergman College at the Australian National University, my old stamping ground, welcome as well. I'm honoured by your presence. Bergman College, for those of you unfamiliar with it, actually is divided into two wings, one called Homer, the other called Barassi. I, as a natural sportsman, why did you laugh? Obviously found myself living in Homer. It was only the intermolectuals, as Homer Simpson would say, who were over there in the Homer wing. My wife, by contrast, was a resident of Homer. Homer and Barassi came together in the union, which is our marriage now, celebrating its 34th year. So thank you to Bergman. Tonight, I've been asked to deliver this Rowan Williams lecture. I warn you one and all, I took this invitation seriously. It is a lecture of an hour. Those of you who need booze, get some, okay? And if you see me drifting off myself, if you get me some as well. I first met Rowan Williams at Lambeth Palace in March of 2009. I had not long been elected the 26th Prime Minister of Australia. He had already been long installed as the 104th Archbishop of Canterbury. There was a little difference in our length of tenure and also in the longevity of the positions we held. I was in London for the G20 summit. Together with others, I had been instrumental in the establishment of the G20 at summit level the previous year in response to the global financial crisis. While the initials GFC now roll easily off our lips, it's worth reminding ourselves that against all the metrics, this was the biggest financial crisis and economic crisis since the Great Depression of 1929-32. These were no ordinary times. I think I can safely say that I was probably the only G20 leader in London at the time who thought it useful to call at Lambeth Palace before going to the G20 conference centre. In those tumultuous times when the world economy stood at the brink, I remember Rowan Williams as a pastoral, practical, and also ethical about the challenges we faced. A combination of Barnabas, the son of encouragement, Bonhoeffer and his theology of viewing from below, and William Booth on what then is to be done. During that visit, together with Prime Minister Gordon Brown, we also addressed a great gathering at St Paul's Cathedral on the impact of the crisis not on financial markets, but on the world's poor. I am rarely fazed, and never intimidated in public life. But if I am to be honest, on that day, in the midst of a genuinely global crisis, standing in the nave of Wren's great cathedral that had risen from the ashes of the Great Fire and 3 centuries later had withstood Hitler's blitz, I was less than confident of my own limited powers than I'd ever been before. Reflecting on what was unfolding around us that day, I said, all these things, require global action on an unprecedented global scale. Just as all those things necessary for the recovery of the general economy as a whole now require global action on an unprecedented scale. And herein lies a further challenge for us all, to act in the global good while recognising at the same time that acting in the global good is also acting in the national good. For centuries, I said, we have been conditioned to think otherwise, whereas the requirement of this age is for global coordination and cooperation on an unprecedented scale. The challenge with the current crisis, as with climate change, now lies beyond the scope of any single nation state to act. I continued, friends, this brings us back to the question of the values which constitute our moral compass for the uncharted journey that lies ahead. For the last quarter of a century, we have been told through the spirit of the age that our principal values are those of security, liberty, and prosperity. These values are entirely legitimate. But to these values of security, liberty, and prosperity must also be grafted the values of equity, of sustainability, and community. So I said at St. Paul's that day. As the history of those tumultuous economic times has now been written, at least in part, we know that the London Conference of March 2009 broke the fall of the global financial crisis. Prior to that conference, global markets had been in free fall for 6 months since the Lehman's collapse. Governments acted together in London with combined fiscal and monetary policy force. Global recession did not become global depression. The slow process of global economic recovery had begun. And while Australia may have avoided recession altogether, it is sobering that as of today, major economies such as Italy are still more than 10% smaller than they were 7 years ago. The point of all this is to say that politics matters. Public policy matters, and the ethical judgments that inform public policy priorities, in this case the importance of people, rather than the purely clinical demands of markets, also matter. The purpose of this lecture is to articulate an ethical approach for Christians and the Christian Church to engage governments on major matters of politics and public policy within the robust framework of a secular state. Its second purpose is to apply this approach to the politics and policy of climate change as we approach the critical 21st Conference of the Parties in Paris later this month. Third, within this framework of a Christian discourse on climate change, my purpose is to challenge the ethical, scientific and policy basis of Cardinal Pell's consistent opposition to the priority attached to climate change action, and to contrast that position with the ethical, scientific and policy imperatives contained in the Pope's encyclical of June 2015, Laudato Si, on care for our common home. The truth is, there is no such thing as an ethically neutral policy position. Whether people are conscious of it or not, ethical judgments, for good or for ill, are made every day in national political life. Judgments about mass unemployment versus the supposedly self-correcting nature of markets. Judgment about the responsibilities we have for the homeless versus the view that social housing is a waste of public finance. Judgments about high-speed broadband access for all to enable full participation in the global economy of the future, not just access for some who happen to live in the smartest suburbs and in the largest cities. Judgments about the position of Indigenous peoples versus a view that past injustices are the responsibility of previous, not present generations. Judgments about the non-refoulement of asylum seekers versus a view that receiving asylum seekers for the purpose of processing the legitimacy of their claims should yield to the pragmatic need of turning the boats back, or in the case of Europe, of erecting fences around national boundaries. judgments about foreign aid to lift the world's poorest out of poverty, versus the view that charity begins at home. And on the eve of the Paris summit on climate change, judgment about the proper stewardship of the planet to ensure basic intergenerational justice for those who follow us, rather than a view that the science is unclear, the future can look after itself, and that technology, if necessary, will solve all. These are all profoundly ethical judgments. They embed judgments about what is right and wrong, about what is better or worse, about what should have priority and about what should not. Anyone who claims in making policy judgments they are doing so oblivious to ethical considerations and instead are simply acting on a simple, value-free premise of common sense is engaged in deep self-delusion. Consciously or not, all our views are shaped by a vast array of ethical assumptions. That does not mean that policy logic does not enter the equation. It must. Core questions such as, will a given policy course of action produce the results that are sought, or will it produce other intended consequences? What will it cost, and can it be funded within the parameters of necessary fiscal discipline, must all be asked and all be answered. In fact, ethics and logic must be equal partners in the public policy process. One is deficient without the other. Noble aspirations in the absence of an effective machinery of government to translate aspiration into measurable action, to paraphrase St. Paul, is a clanging cymbal and a sounding gong. Ethical consideration should, however, be our starting point. The question arises, therefore, as to how in political life ethical judgments are to be formed and how they are to be argued in the public square. And in the case of what is called Christian ethics, how are these to be reconciled within the legitimately secular framework of contemporary democratic politics? Rowan Williams has sought to address these questions in a collection of essays, recently collated in a book entitled Faith in the Public Square. He wrestles with the core question of whether it is legitimate for any person in a secular state to articulate a policy position grounded in religious faith, rather than arguing that proposition in exclusively secular terms. While it may be seen as an unwelcome view among the community of faith, secularism, in my strongest personal view, is a necessary precondition for modern political discourse. We are all familiar with the multiple abuses of religious authority, Catholic or Protestant, throughout Western history, when a particular religious orthodoxy has been preferenced by the political authority of the time. The often bloody history of the institutional church over 18 centuries post-Constantine, their Muslim counterparts over 14 centuries, and more recently between Catholics and Protestants in the centuries following the Reformation of 1517, provide a resounding case for a secular state as the lesser of many evils, a place where propositions can be advanced and argued without any recourse to any claims of higher revelation, or recourse to the coercive powers of baser politics in the name of God. Yet support for a secular state must not blind us to the bloody history of state terrorism in the worst forms that we have seen in the 20th century through totalitarian fascism and communism. It is a futile exercise to attempt to calculate the atrocities attributable to Hitler, to Stalin, Tojo, and the Second World War on the one hand, and the wars of religion, which in some estimates wiped out one-third of the then population of Europe on the other, to provide some sort of moral matrix as to which of these contending isms was the least bloodthirsty. The enduring lesson of both extremes is that unless a state is subject to constitutional forms of government which provide effective protection for individual and minority rights in exchange for people respecting certain defined responsibilities of the state as part of a political compact between the state and the people, systematic abuse is always possible. Rowan Williams argues that there are two forms of secularism in the 21st century, what he calls programmatic secularism, as opposed to procedural secularism. The former he defines as, and I quote him, an exclusive public orthodoxy of a new kind that works on the assumption that only one sort of loyalty is really possible. Loyalty to your faith will be a matter of private preference, but cannot stand alongside loyalty to the state, to the supposedly neutral public order of rational persons, unquote. This Rowan Williams contrasts with what he calls procedural secularism, in which public policy declines to give advantage or preference to any one religious body over others, but in which the state defines its role as one of overseeing a variety of communities of religious conviction, and where necessary, helping them to keep the peace together. In an age of declining religious conviction, at least within the Christian tradition, we should add to the latter a definition of a variety of communities of conviction, whether they happen to be religious or not. It is patently too absurd to imply in the 20th century that ethical views on the role of the state in general, or on a particular direction in public policy, can only derive from religious communities. The reality today is that there are multiple ethical communities which seek to influence government policy, where common policy conclusions may often be reached while employing radically different ethical methodologies. We see this today, for example, on the question of climate change, where communities of scientists, communities of environmentalists, communities of Christian activists, including no less than the Pope himself, find themselves in common policy cause, and critically, all arguing within a common secular political space. What then should be the particular contribution of Christians and the Christian Church to such debates? And what is the proper granularity of this contribution, where political ethics intersect with detailed policy design, including that universal, uncomfortable reality we call public finance? These are complex questions which warrant responses beyond the supreme banality that the church should stay out of politics. This is the simplistic refrain of a political class incapable of dealing with challenges to their own secular ex cathedra proclamations as to what is right and what is wrong. The church, it is said by the same class, should stick to spiritual matters and keep well clear of the political, invariably leaving undefined what is meant by the term political on any given day. This begs the further question of how these terms spiritual and political might best be considered in the age-old debate between church and state. If by spiritual it is contended that we are dealing with the non-material, then that presents a small problem, given the fact that the vast bulk of the Gospels are very material indeed, describing how the Jesus of history walked the earth, lived an exemplary ethical life in support of the many underclasses with whom he engaged, and charged his followers to go and live likewise. Yet according to the very same biblical tradition, this physical Jesus, however, was also to become the Christ of eternity, with his call to repentance, salvation, and resurrection. Christians are not left with a choice between the two. The uncomfortable truth, for both the liberal and conservative traditions of the church, is that the Gospels speak of both the physical and spiritual imperatives to be embraced by Christ's followers. It follows, therefore, that if we are to be concerned about the physical well-being of our fellow human beings, as well as the broader created order that supports them, are we simply to be concerned with individual philanthropic action, or also the collective action of corporations, communities, and the state? It would be hard-pressed to find a reference in the Gospels to support an entirely privatised or pietistic Christianity, which exonerates its adherents from public action in defence of the basic ethical principles both lived and espoused by Jesus of Nazareth. If that is so, Christians automatically find themselves engaged in political action, whether we choose to explicitly recognise it or not. Are we then to contend that there are certain no-go areas where the church should remain silent? Theological conservatives would argue that if the church is to be politically active, it should limit its voice to questions of life, death, sex, sexuality, and definitions of the integrity of the family. The church is perfectly right to engage in these public political debates, as all form part of a comprehensive approach to Christian ethics. But for such conservatives to contend that ethical considerations beyond these personal domains breach the limits of permissible political action, either by the church corporately or by Christians individually, is without biblical foundation. We are equally called upon to deliberate on the great questions of war and peace, bearing in mind that it was Pope John Paul II who, in relation to the Iraq War, defined that war as unjust. We're also called upon in the secular space and in the spiritual space to debate the cancer of political corruption in our Western democracies. Just as we are asked to reflect on the central ethical questions of the economy concerning poverty, inequality and sustainability. The question which then presents itself is if Christian ethics permits and arguably encourages active political engagement across the public policy debate, then what ethical principles should guide this engagement? This is indeed a complex domain in which generations of theologians have been engaged at least since Aquinas and arguably since Constantine nearly 1,000 years before. But certain core principles permeate the tradition, including 1, an acceptance of the inherent, irreducible and universal dignity of human beings. 2, a parallel acceptance of the intrinsic equality of all human beings. 3, respect for the moral freedom of individuals to make free moral choices for their lives. 4, a requirement to love all human beings consistent with the Great Commandment. 5, a universal preferencing of the poor, the marginalised and the oppressed. 6, a requirement to support and provide self-giving care for the strangers in our midst consistent with the challenging parable of the Good Samaritan. 7, a requirement to tend, care for and be the stewards of the created order that sustains us all, as reflected, for example, in the deep theology of St. Francis of Assisi. Each of these is subject of further definitional debate, including the adequacy of this list in itself. And of course, there is controversy concerning their specific application, that is, the application of these principles, to the particularities of the political and policy circumstances of the time. But we delude ourselves, or perhaps too easily forgive ourselves, if we conclude that the complexities of each of these debates exonerates the Christian community from forming an ethical view on the great questions of our time. I recently sat in the comfortable pews of an affluent Anglican parish in London, where the uncomfortable reading of the day was indeed the parable of the Good Samaritan. This was in the context of the European response to the Syrian refugee crisis. The bold response from the pulpit was that we should pray for our political leaders to have wisdom, nothing else. I sometimes despair of Henry's church. Of course, the critique is then raised, both by the political class and the conservative theological class, that having an informed ethical view is impossible because Christians in the church collectively do not have the professional or technical competence to offer cogent comment on the specific policy alternatives of the day. My own view is that unless there is at least one institution, such as the church, dedicated to posing the ethical dilemmas present in the public policy debate, there is a grave danger that these debates automatically become subsumed by the pragmatic considerations of politics and the public finance of the day. In fact, my further view is that it is a legitimate function of the church in the collective West of the 21st century to make the state permanently ethically uncomfortable with itself because of the compromises the state will inevitably make with the passage of each law or the termination of each executive government policy. Again, unless there is at least one institution seeking to construct, maintain and argue the continuing ethical parameters within which the stated purpose and unintended consequences of government action should be considered, then there is a greater risk that public policy simply degenerates into interest group politics, where the voices of the most powerful almost inevitably prevail, or even worse, where retail politics simply becomes public policy by another name. Again, it must be emphasised that Christians have no natural monopoly in framing the ethical dimensions of any public policy debate. In Rowan Williams' construct of procedural secularism, Christian ethical perspective should be simply one of a number of ethical voices seeking to obtain traction in the public square. Nor should Christians enjoy any particular privilege. It is also important that the Church argue its perspectives both from a Christian worldview and, where possible, from a rational worldview, given that the latter is the common language of multiple voices continued to be heard in the public square. To be clear, there should be no apology for advancing an ethical proposition anchored in Christian theology. But to be effective, in the public discourse of a secular state. Its translation into parallel rational propositions, which nonetheless share a common ethical endpoint, is optimal, although not essential. Given the long historical discourse within the Church between Thomists, between faith and reason, and between evidence and revelation, Christians should be entirely comfortable in bridging, wherever possible, the contending disciplines of theology and the academy when addressing the ethics of public policy. This brings us to the final question of the particular responsibilities of the Christian legislator, active in the community of faith, while also needing to communicate an ethical position in the common language of the secular political discourse. This in particular requires a comfortable relationship between faith and reason, of the type that Catholic and Anglican social teachings have long embraced. The worst that can occur in the post-Christian collective West is for Christians active in the political process to publicly rely on either divine revelation or theological abstraction to argue an ethical proposition in the public square. The Christian Church can do so, if it so chooses. But the Christian legislator, if she or he is to be effective, cannot. The process of translation from the imperatives of faith, however deeply held to the methodologies of reason and empiricism, is important. Given these various considerations concerning the interrelationship between Christian ethics and the public policy process, how do these principles apply to the great continuing global debate on climate change? This is important, given that the 21st Conference of the Parties to the International Framework Convention on Climate Change is to be held in Paris, and that conference is now only a matter of weeks away. It is doubly important because the Australian Christian community, like the Australian political community, remains divided on climate change, just as there remain divisions across the world. My position on climate change derives from a combination of factors. My personal conclusions on the ethics, the objective conclusions of the science as reflected in the long-term analysis of the International Panel of Climate Change Scientists, and the established capacity of national and international public policy to make a measurable difference on climate change futures. All three sets of considerations were relevant and remain relevant in shaping my own position on climate change. For me, the principles of international intergenerational justice were particularly important, and the responsibilities that flow from these for those in public office today. I signed the ratification instrument for the Kyoto Protocol as my first act as Prime Minister of Australia in 2007, consistent with pre-election commitments and within 1 hour of swearing the oath of office. For me, this was no small matter. There was also a practical reason for this. The 14th Conference of the Parties was at the same time convening in Bali. Global negotiations had ground to a halt, aided by the fact that both the United States and Australia at that time were the only major developed economies to have refused to ratify Kyoto since it was first adopted in 1997. It was important to provide those negotiations with fresh momentum. That is why I then travelled to Bali to deliver personally the instrument of ratification to the UN Secretary General. The United States, as a result, was left isolated on the conference floor. The conference subsequently adopted and agreed what became known as the Bali Roadmap, which succeeded in keeping international negotiations alive over subsequent years, with that road ultimately leading to Paris this year. It is fair to state that the radical change in the Australian negotiating position on climate change made a contribution to the conference outcome. However, signing an international protocol is one thing. Fulfilling the national obligations that follow from such a protocol on targets and timelines for reducing greenhouse gases, that's something else. Just over a year on, we had legislated, notwithstanding a hostile Senate, for a mandatory renewable energy target of 20% of total electricity supply by 2020. As of 2007, total renewable energy accounted for only 5% of total supply. As of 2014, just after the government left office, it accounted for 13% of supply, enough to power some 4.5 million average homes for a year, or nearly half the total national housing stock. In 2008-09, the government sought to legislate twice for a national emissions trading scheme, but was defeated in the Senate before a carbon tax was finally introduced in 2012, before being repealed in 2014 by the succeeding Conservative government. Our government also engaged in direct subsidy programs to improve household energy efficiency and the installation of solar panels on roofs, from only 8,000 homes when we were elected in 2007 to more than a million by 2014, or nearly 15% of the total housing stock. On coal, given Australia is one of the largest coal exporters in the world, the government invested in the world's largest carbon capture and storage project, with the establishment of the Global Carbon Capture and Storage Institute, with the object of bringing CCS projects to scale. In addition, the government introduced the Clean Energy Future Plan, which included the carbon pricing mechanism, plus the establishment of the Clean Energy Regulator, the Carbon Farming Initiative, the National Greenhouse and Energy Reporting System, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, and the establishment of the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, ARENA. The government also introduced the Greenhouse and Energy Minimum Standards, which became a national framework for appliances and equipment energy efficiency in Australia. Each of these policy measures was controversial. Each involved considerable political and industry opposition, often vociferous and invariably well-funded. But the impact of these various measures on actual greenhouse reductions was measurable. As of 2007, Australian total annual greenhouse gas emissions was 602.5 million tonnes of carbon equivalent. As of 2014, this had been reduced to 563 million tonnes of carbon equivalent, or by nearly 7% compared to when the government first came to office. According to Reputex, one of the leading modelling agencies working on the cumulative impact of greenhouse gas mitigation measures, the current government's direct action model will see greenhouse gas emissions increase from 563 million tonnes of carbon equivalent in 2014 to 613 MTC by 2020. This would represent an 8.5% increase in annual GHG emissions against the level we had managed to reduce them to as of 2014. Furthermore, this nearly 7% reduction in GHG emissions between 2007 and 2014, as a consequence of the previous government's policy, also stands in stark contrast to the Australian emissions record prior to 2007. Under the Howard government, GHG emissions during its last 8 years in office increased from 566 million tonnes of carbon equivalent to over 600 million tonnes of carbon equivalent, or an increase of 8.5%. While some may argue that the achievements of the last 7 years arise from reduced economic activity as a consequence of the global financial crisis, it's important to note that unlike other developed economies, the Australian economy actually continued to grow during this period. In other words, we are able to establish the basic proposition that public policy actually worked in delivering real reductions in greenhouse gases without impairing economic growth. Australia also went within a few months from being a global pariah state on climate change to one of the leading global actors in trying to frame a binding global agreement by the time of the Copenhagen summit at the end of 2009. We were co-founders of the so-called Cartagena Group of States, which worked tirelessly through a series of international video conferences in the months leading up to Copenhagen to try to drive consensus across the international community. In the end, as everyone knows, the Copenhagen conference failed to produce a binding global agreement. This was not through any lack of effort, including in the negotiating room in Copenhagen itself, where some 25 of us, including the presidents or prime ministers of the United States, of Germany, of France, Britain, Japan, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, and Australia, met for nearly 2 days with little sleep to try and hammer out an agreement. In the absence of a binding global treaty, we still managed to produce a Copenhagen Declaration, which for the first time reached global agreement on a 2 degrees centigrade target, on the joint responsibility of both developed and developing countries to produce that outcome, and on a global system, thirdly, of global measurement, reporting and verification. And it was the contents of this declaration that was then formally gavelled into international legal recognition the following year in 2010, at the 15th conference of the parties in Cancun in Mexico. The reason I render these policy measures and their results in some considerable detail is because in government I judged it necessary not simply to state an ethical proposition concerning climate change, but also to act on that proposition through practical policy initiatives whose effect could subsequently be measured. You will recall I was attacked from all sides for stating that climate change was the greatest moral challenge of our time. I stand by that statement today. My reasoning was based on the official advice of the government's scientific advisers that the impact of global warming in excess of 2 degrees centigrade this century was both dangerous and potentially irreversible. Moreover, this impact would be experienced first and most severely by the poorest and most vulnerable members of the human family, who lack the most basic social protections. Through a combination of the coastal inundation of river delta areas around the Ganges and the Irrawaddy, the disappearance of small island states altogether, such as Kiribati and the Maldives, the increased frequency and intensity of extreme weather events, food and water insecurity, and new patterns of exotic diseases in developing regions from the Americas to Africa to South Asia. These were not small matters. These, in fact, are large matters. Furthermore, the impact on other life forms and the Earth itself raised deep questions about our proper stewardship of the wider natural order, well beyond the particular needs of the human family. In other words, the all-encompassing scale of the consequences of a failure to act effectively on climate change was, in my view, sufficient to support its description as the greatest ethical challenge of our time. I also believe over the decades ahead, this statement will stand the test of time. Those who attacked this particular formulation were not only the usual legion of climate change sceptics and deniers. It included those corporations who concluded that policy change would be financially injurious to their bottom line and who therefore found it convenient to join forces with the deniers and to fund them handsomely. But it also included those who accused me of not living up to my own word by accepting the advice of my most senior government ministers that following the second defeat of the government's emissions trading scheme legislation, we should defer its implementation for 2 years until the conclusion of the Kyoto Protocol's commitment period in and around 2012. As I was Prime Minister at the time, I fully accept responsibility for this decision and for its poor communication to the Australian public. As for the related attack that my stated belief in the moral significance of climate change should have resulted in a double disillusion, I would draw attention to the fact that as of June 2010, the window for calling a double disillusion was still open and remained open until August of that year, notwithstanding the fact that the most senior ministers in the government were fundamentally opposed to any such course of action. But once again, as the Prime Minister of the day, I have taken and continue to take full responsibility for the decisions taken at this time. As a political leader in the midst of a bloody political debate on one of the most contentious policy issues before the government, I readily concede, as I have on many previous public occasions, that I could have done many things better in managing the climate change debate than I did. That is a truth confronting political leaders around the world. The fact remains, however, that the real climate change measures we were able to enact did have an effect of reducing Australian greenhouse gas emissions by nearly 7%. More needed to be done, more needs to be done, but a corner was turned. But the Australian people spoke on this key electoral matter in 2013 when they supported a political party that committed itself to repealing a carbon price, and this the new government did. Whatever the real or perceived successes or failures of the government that I led in its ethics and its actions on climate change during its period in office, the fact remains that there was not just a debate in the Parliament on this contentious issue, there was a wide debate on climate change as well. This debate did not only include the usual range of interest groups, it also included the Australian churches. I emphasise this because my subject in this lecture is faith, ethics and climate change. I have already sought to describe how I frame my own position. Many of the Christian churches supported that position. Others opposed. And in this context, the leader of the Christian opposition was Cardinal George Pell, until recently the Cardinal Archbishop of Sydney and now the Prefect for the Economy in the Holy See in Rome. Cardinal Pell's position on climate change is worth exploring. His policy positions are stated with great clarity, and given his status, they should be treated with respect and engaged on their merits. And given his recent appointment to Rome, His views are now not just relevant to Australia, but also the world. This is particularly the case as we approach the Paris Climate Summit, where Cardinal Pell's position on climate change is publicly at variance with that of the Pope and the latter's most recent encyclical, Laudato Si. Furthermore, Cardinal Pell's position continues to be widely reported in the Australian media, and in Australia, public and political opinion continues to remain divided. Of course, we now focus on the policies which the Australian government will be taking to Paris in 2 weeks' time. And for these reasons, among others, it's important to analyse Cardinal Pell's position clearly and to provide a response to them. Lest there be any doubt, it's important we understand the time sequence. The Pope's encyclical, which deals with human responsibility for the environment in general, and in part with climate change more specifically, was released on 18 June 2015. On 16 July, barely a month later, Cardinal Pell, in speaking about the encyclical, is quoted in the Financial Times as stating that it's, namely the encyclicals, got many, many interesting elements. There are parts of it which are beautiful, he says, but the Church has no particular expertise in science. The Church has got no mandate from the Lord to pronounce on scientific matters. We believe in the autonomy of science, added Cardinal Pell. This statement is directly targeted at the fundamental scientific underpinnings of the ethical and policy positions espoused in the papal encyclical. This is not a new position for Cardinal Pell. It is remarkable, given his standing, that he would launch such a public broadside against the encyclical, carrying papal authority almost immediately upon its release. In multiple public articles, Cardinal Pell, as a non-scientist, has over many years consistently attacked the scientific consensus agreed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as well as the overall merit of the policy actions embraced within the framework of the International Convention on Climate Change. Cardinal Pell has variously described these as hysterical, an example of pagan emptiness, and including the remarkable statement that, quote, in the past, pagans sacrificed animals and even humans in vain attempts to placate capricious and cruel gods, and today they demand reductions in carbon emissions, unquote. I directly quote the good cardinal. Cardinal Pell has in the past accused me of inflated rhetoric, and perhaps on some questions he was quite right. But such rhetoric, it seems, is not the exclusive province of prime ministers. Princes of the Church are apparently not entirely immune. Whereas Cardinal Pell has described global warming as simply today's most powerful and pervasive myth, quote unquote, 2 years into my own government and struggling to secure passage of an emissions trading scheme through a hostile Australian Senate, the Cardinal Archbishop of Sydney made his point with crystal clear clarity. He said, and I quote, most Australians for the moment seem to believe in global warming primarily induced by humans, or even in humanly induced catastrophic global warming. Cardinal Pell continued, there is not sufficient scientific evidence for either of these claims, less evidence that we should influence or reverse such climate outcomes, and less again that we could afford to attempt any of this. Religion has no monopoly on truth or human folly, unquote. Cardinal Pell wrote this in October 2009, less than 2 months before the Copenhagen Conference on Climate Change, which, as noted above, failed to reach agreement on a globally binding treaty. This failure continues to cast a long shadow over the Paris Conference 6 years later. In 2011, the Cardinal expanded on his pessimism about the pointlessness of public policy responses to climate change in what he continued to contend to be the uncertain science. He wrote, I quote him, the rewards for proper environmental behaviour are uncertain, unlike the grim scenarios for the future as a result of human irresponsibility, which have a dash of the apocalyptic about them. The immense financial cost true believers would impose on economies can be compared with the sacrifices offered traditionally in religion and the sale of carbon credits with the Reformation practice of selling indulgences. The costs of attempts to make global warming go away will be very heavy. They may be levied initially on the big polluters, but they will eventually trickle down to the end users. Efforts to offset the effects on the vulnerable are well-intentioned, but history tells us they will only be partially successful. In summary, Cardinal Pell's position on climate change is clear. First, he argues this is a matter for science, and the Church has no mandate from the Lord to pronounce on scientific matters. Second, he argues, based on his own extensive reading of what he calls this stuff, by which he presumably means the science, that there is no scientific proof of global warming to the extent that it should cause policymakers to be concerned. Yet in doing so, the Cardinal appears not to reflect on the profound contradiction in his position, that as a non-scientist, he then proclaims that the conclusions of the International Panel of Climate Change Scientists, made up of thousands of scientists from almost all UN member states, are not simply open to question, but they are simply wrong, in the Cardinal's view. Third, the Cardinal asserts that the cost of any policy intervention to arrest global warming is prohibitive for the economy and unfair to the poor, when measured against any modest gain to be derived for the planet from so acting. My argument is not that Cardinal Pell should not be free to make such commentary on climate change, notwithstanding the fact that his position happened to mirror almost precisely that of the former opposition leader and later Prime Minister, Mr. Abbott, whose considered conclusions on these subjects was that, and I quote him, the climate change argument is absolute crap, unquote. I believe Cardinal Pell's position on climate change should feature as much in the public debate as anybody else's. Just as he should be entirely free to opine on the ethics of economic policy, social policy, including those policy debates traditionally associated with the life issues. I might disagree, or I might agree with him on some or all of the above. But to contend that a necessary prerequisite for engagement in these ethical debates in the public square is to be a professionally qualified climate scientist, or a life scientist, or even an economist, would by definition also render his own contribution to these debates null and void, as I understand Cardinal Pell is qualified in none. Nor am I so qualified. But the absence of necessary technical qualifications should not prevent any Christian of properly informed conscience from reflecting an ethical view on important public policy debates being conducted in the public square. And in doing so, we should seek to bring to bear the core and continuing ethical principles referred to earlier. On the substance of Cardinal Pell's position, it will come as no surprise to you that I fundamentally disagree with his conclusions on climate change, on the science, on the policy, on the ethics. On the science, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Scientists have concluded that anthropogenic climate change is a scientific reality, that based on business as usual, we are currently on track to see a temperature increase of 4 degrees, and that this in turn will have catastrophic consequences for humankind, biodiversity and the planet. While there are questions and debates about precisely when and how climate change impacts will be felt, 97 to 98% of peer-reviewed scientific literature agrees that the world is getting significantly warmer as a result of human activity. That's on the ethics. On policy, the same IPCC IPCC scientists tell us that the only way to avoid these consequences is to keep temperature increases within 2 degrees. By radically reducing the annual amount of greenhouse gas emissions to the level that they peak at 450 parts per million of carbon equivalent. This requires a range of policies to reduce demand for fossil fuel energy and to convert to clean, or at least cleaner, energy solutions on the supply side. As for the argument that these measures have no effect, as noted above, the data demonstrate that in Australia's case alone, the policy measures introduced from 2007 did have effect and saw Australia's greenhouse gas emissions fall significantly. Furthermore, this downward emissions trajectory has occurred alongside growing incomes in Australia, which increased by 22.75% between 2007 and 2014, in real terms, according to the World Bank. Australia's experiences, like a growing number of others around the world, demonstrate that economic growth need not depend on runaway greenhouse gas emissions. These uncomfortable truths would tend to undermine Cardinal Pell's proposition that it is unproven that climate change policy does not have an effect and that these policies impair the economy and people's incomes. On this, in fact, the data demonstrates he is plain wrong. On ethics, I believe that when national political leaders are provided with unambiguous scientific advice from the authoritative international scientific community, established for this purpose some 27 years ago, and here I refer to the International Panel of Climate Change Scientists, then those political leaders have an ethical responsibility to act to avoid the consequences of the threat of which they have been formally warned. To fail to do so would be an enormous breach of the equivalent of national fiduciary duty. In fact, I do not believe the political leaders have the moral latitude to dismiss the official, long-standing scientific consensus based on their own personal scientific readings. Cardinal Pell might enjoy that moral luxury. Prime ministers do not. Furthermore, political leaders face the unique challenge of acting in the interest not of just of this generation, but also the next, raising in turn profound ethical questions of intergenerational justice, way beyond the responsibilities arising from any near-term electoral cycle. And finally, from a Christian perspective, there is also an ethical imperative arising from preferencing the poor as the most vulnerable to climate change, as well as our common responsibilities for the proper stewardship of the natural order on which all human beings ultimately depend. Pope Francis's encyclical entitled Laudato Si on care for our common home speaks with equal clarity as Cardinal Pell, but with radically different conclusions. Francis states that the purpose of his encyclical is to, and I quote him, to draw on the results of the best scientific research available today, letting them touch us deeply and provide a concrete foundation for the ethical and spiritual itinerary that follows. Unless we should conclude that this is simply a part of a broader academic teaching by the Church, Francis then states that he intends to, and I quote him again, advance some broader proposals for dialogue and action which will involve each of us as individuals and also affect international policy, unquote. Furthermore, his cyclical has an urgency attached to it. He states, and I quote him again, I urgently appeal then for a new dialogue about how we are shaping the future of our planet. We need a conversation which includes everyone, since the environmental challenge we are undergoing and its human roots concern and affect us all, unquote. The Pope defines climate as, quote, a common good belonging to all and meant for all, unquote. He then outlines, based on the science, this common good for our common creation is now threatened by climate change. He says, and I quote him again, there is very solid scientific consensus that now indicates that we are presently witnessing a disturbing warming of the climate system. In recent decades, this warming has been accompanied by a constant rise in the sea level, and it would appear by an increase in extreme weather events, even if a scientifically determinable cause cannot be assigned to each particular phenomenon. It is true, the Pope continues, that there are other factors, such as volcanic activity, variations in the Earth's orbit and axis and solar cycle, yet a number of scientific studies indicate that most global warming in recent decades is due to the great concentration of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen oxides and others, released mainly as a result of human activity. Concentrated in the atmosphere, these gases not only allow the warmth of the sun rays reflected by the Earth to be dispersed into space, this problem is aggravated by a model of development based on the intensive use of fossil fuels, which is at the heart of the worldwide energy system. Another determining factor has been the increase in changed uses of the soil, principally deforestation for agricultural purposes. So says the Pope on the science. The encyclical goes on to outline the impact of global warming. Global warming has effects on the carbon cycle. It creates a vicious circle, which aggravates the situation even more, affecting the availability of our central resources, like drinking water, energy, and agricultural production in warmer regions, and leading to the extinction of the part of the planet's biodiversity. The melting of the polar ice caps can lead to the dangerous release of methane gas, while the decomposition of frozen organic material can further increase the emission of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide pollution increases the acidification of the oceans and compromises the marine food chain. If present trends continue, the Pope warns, this century may well witness extraordinary climate change and an unprecedented destruction of ecosystems with serious consequences for us all, unquote. As for the ethical imperative, Pope Francis is clear-cut. Quote, climate change is a global problem with grave implications, environmental, social, economic, political, and for the distribution of goods. It represents one of the principal challenges facing humanity in our day. Its worst impact will probably be felt by developing countries in coming decades. Many of the poor, he says, live in areas particularly affected by phenomena related to warming, and their means of subsistence are largely dependent on natural reserves and ecosystem services such as agriculture, fishing, and forestry. On the question of public policy, Pope Francis is equally clear-cut. He says there is an urgent need to develop policies so that in the next few years the emission of carbon dioxide and other highly polluting gases can be drastically reduced, for example, replacing fossil fuels and developing sources of renewable energy. As for those sceptical about the environmental consequences of current patterns of behaviour, the Pope himself is scathing. He says, as often happens in periods of deep crisis which require bold decisions, we are tempted to think that what is happening is not entirely clear. Such evasiveness serves as a license to carry on with our present lifestyles and models of production and consumption. This is the way human beings contrive to feed their self-destructive vices, he says. Try not to see them, try not to acknowledge them, delaying the important decisions and pretending that nothing will happen, unquote. On specific policy recommendations to deal with climate change, Pope Francis treads carefully. He is clear on the science, he is clear on the ethics, he is clear on the imperative for policy action, but he is mindful of the complexity of the technical policy debate about particular policy responses. Francis says, on many concrete questions, the Church has no reason to offer a definitive opinion. She knows that honest debate must be encouraged among experts while respecting divergent views. But we need only to take a frank look at the fact to see that our common home is falling into serious disrepair. And the Pope would have us recognise that there is always a way out, and we can always redirect our steps, that we can always do something to solve our problems. He concludes, still we see signs that things are now reaching a breaking point due to the rapid pace of change and degradation. It is plain for all to see that Pope Francis's position on science, on the ethics and the policy imperatives of climate change are fundamentally different to those articulated by Cardinal Pell, both before the papal encyclical and since the papal encyclical. Conservatives in the Church often speak of the danger of causing confusion among the laity, among the many complex questions arising from the Church's social teaching. These concerns have been reflected more broadly in the most recent Synod in the Family in Rome. We must, however, have some sympathy for the confusion among the laity in this other area of the Church's social teaching, namely climate change and the environment, where a prince of the Church elects to embrace a position in such fundamental contradiction to that of the papal encyclical. The Pope says the science on climate change is sufficiently clear. Cardinal Pell says it is not, and further, the purported science is without foundation. The Pope says all of humanity faces a common ethical challenge to protect the planet from climate change. But because Cardinal Pell disputes the science, he says there is little, if any, ethical imperative at all. And on the question of the policy imperative, the Pope speaks with urgency. Cardinal Pell describes policy measures as an unnecessary fad, an unacceptable cost to both companies and consumers. Finally, a careful reading of the cyclical will also see perhaps a preemptive papal riposte to climate change sceptics within the Church. This can be found in paragraph 217 of the encyclical, where he says, quote, the external deserts in the world are growing because the internal deserts have become so vast. For this reason, the ecological crisis is also a summons to profound interior conversion, says the Pope. It must be said that some committed and prayerful Christians, with the excuse of realism and pragmatism, tend to ridicule expressions of concern for the environment. Others are passive, they choose not to change their habits and thus become inconsistent. So what they all need is, to use the Pope's term, ecological conversion, whereby the effects of their encounter with Jesus Christ become evident in their relationship with the world around them. Living our vocation, the Pope says, to be protectors of God's handiwork is essential to a life of virtue. It is not an optional or a secondary aspect of our Christian experience, unquote. Perhaps the Pope had Cardinal Pell in mind when this paragraph was written for the encyclical. Of course, Cardinal Pell and those who would support him in this debate might argue that these conflicting positions on climate change are legitimate debates within the Church, and that those outside the Church have no business involving themselves in these debates. There is, however, a problem with this logic. Namely, the Pope in his encyclical explicitly addresses his remarks to the wider community when he says, and I quote him, in this encyclical I would like to enter dialogue with all peoples, about our common home, And in doing so, of course, Pope Francis follows in the long tradition of Pope Paul VI, John Paul II and Benedict XVI in addressing their concerns about environmental degradation to all peoples of goodwill. After many years of silence in response to Cardinal Pell's public critique of my government's policy on climate change at the time, the reason I've chosen to enter the debate now is on the eve of the Paris conference, we once again enter into a critical time for Australia and the world on climate change. Prime Minister Turnbull will be carefully considering what approach Australia should adopt, both in Paris and beyond. So too will the rest of the international community as each nation prepares its own national policy commitments for the Paris conference. It is therefore no small matter at this most critical of times for the ethical waters, at least in the community of faith, to be so deeply muddied by such radical climate change sceptics as Cardinal Pell, and for his commentary to largely go without challenge. Of course, he is free to contribute to the public policy debate in any manner he wishes, but it is equally important, particularly now that Cardinal Pell has become a genuinely global figure, to have his own almost ex cathedra statements on climate change challenged by others in the public space. It's high time his views were confronted head on. The stakes are now far too high for us all. To conclude, as the conference of the parties approaches, there are grounds for both optimism and caution concerning the most likely outcome. There is optimism that the international community may have learned some of the lessons from Copenhagen. To some extent, this is reflected in radically changed policy positions in Beijing, in New Delhi, and further change in Washington as well. These are very large emitters of greenhouse gases. The truth is, there still remains a vast gap between aspiration and reality. The cold, hard reality is that based on the aggregation of current international commitments on greenhouse gas reduction, the planet will not be able to sustain temperatures increases within the 2-degree threshold. In fact, several recent calculations include that current national commitments, when aggregated, will still see temperatures increasing globally by 3.5 degrees by century's end. While this is better than business as usual, it still falls far short of the reductions necessary to achieve our 2-degree target. There is, therefore, much, much more work to be done. From a scientific, ethical and practical policy perspective, it is critical that when governments gather in Paris, that their agreements countenance the possibility of governments reconvening in the future in order to revisit the inadequacy of the international commitments made thus far. Current commitments go one quarter of the distance, or based on other calculations, perhaps one third of the distance they need to travel. If the Paris Agreement including the national statements associated with it, do not embrace the possibility of an early return to the conference table so that more ambitious commitments can be made, then there is a real danger that we will fall radically short of the mark. Ultimately, our planet does not lie. Pope Francis' encyclical provides us with the clarity of ethical guidance on the question of climate change and the international community, and, of course, this is guidance which the world needs. He reflected this also in his recent address to the United Nations General Assembly. His address was remarkably well received by the international community, Christian and non-Christian alike. The responsibility of the rest of us, including governments around the world, is to respond to his unequivocal, universal, ethical call to action, and those like it from other religious and non-religious leaders around the world, and to do so with concrete policy action which sustains this, our common home, for the future. I thank you.
Well, friends, Kevin has very kindly agreed to field one or two questions. We've only got at most about 5 minutes for that, but if anyone would like to ask a question or make a comment, particularly as Kevin's impressed upon us the urgency of the present moment in which we are living, then please take the most of your opportunity now. And there are some microphones going around the hall. Somebody here in the Dorothy, yes, in the third row.
Thank you very much.
Could you just say who you are, please?
Sorry, I'm Dorothy Lee. I'm the head of theology here at Trinity. Thank you very much for your address. I really enjoyed it, and it was very sobering and very stimulating. I was at a recent symposium at St Andrew's Orthodox Theological College in Sydney, and at which John Chryzavgis, Father John Chryzavgis, was speaking. He's the archdeacon to the Ecumenical Patriarchate, and he was talking about Laudato Si. And I find it extraordinary that Cardinal Pell, it's not just an ethical failure, as you so well point out, but it's a fundamental theological failure, because if you look at Bartholomaeus and the sort of pronouncements he's made on climate change, you find there a theology that's really grounded strongly in creation and an understanding of redemption in relation to creation. And that makes a huge difference, I think, to the way we see things. So I don't know where Cardinal Pell's theology is coming from.
Well, I've had the great opportunity, I think, as Foreign Minister of Australia, to meet with the Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople, Istanbul, and in fact had discussions with him on this very subject. And you're right, he speaks with great eloquence. And if you read the Pope's encyclical, he makes much reference to the Ecumenical Patriarch in the actual document. You say you're head of theology here at Trinity. I am not. I'm not the head of theology anywhere. And so I'll leave that to the good theologians to debate. But on the question of ethics, which is where I've constrained my remarks, it's where plainly the direct discourse intersects with those engaged in, shall I call it, secular ethics and religious ethics, or Christian ethics, and those in the secular marketplace. And therefore I am required to take a position. And that's why I've done so in the way in which I've approached it.
And the front row down here, please.
Good evening. My name's Tyson. I'm an undergraduate student here at Trinity. And my question is basically an ethical one. A lot of the detractors or the opponents of action towards climate change don't necessarily deny science sometimes, but also ask the question, well, as Australians, we proportionally amongst the global contributors to global warming have a minimal or a negligible contribution to that. Do you believe that our so-called minimal contribution to global warming is enough to negate our ethical imperative to act?
I think the relevant, let me now hazard an observation which lies somewhere in that difficult terrain between ethics and theology. Think of the story of the widow's mite. I mean, it didn't actually cause the public finances of the then Roman administration or of the synagogue to turn one way or the other, but it was a big contribution. All I'm suggesting is we make a proportional contribution. Secondly, let me tell you that Australia around the world is not just regarded as your average kind of, you know, irrelevancy in international relations. This is the number 12 economy in the world out of 192 in terms of size. Our global footprint counts. We are the largest coal exporting economy, or the second largest one in the world. Therefore, what we do on these questions is not only noted, it is measured. And the very simple principle applies that if one major developed economy thinks it has the moral luxury of stepping out of the system, then you create, by definition, the ethical precedent for other larger emitters to do the same. Therefore, I believe we have, both objectively and by way of example, a significant role to play. And I think that's one of the sobering aspects of this debate which we in Australia need to be aware of. It's not just a matter for us to reflect on. It is actually a substantive question. The number of UN officials I've spoken to in the last 2 years worried in a deep way about the Australian position and how it will be reflected in Paris. These are not just a bunch of lefties running around the world looking for moral succour and support. These are people concerned about an actual conference outcome, and that the diminution of an Australian voice would have a profound impact on diluting the Paris outcome, which I've already indicated is of itself deficient against what is needed longer term. But absence of Paris outcome, absent at least travelling a half or a quarter or a third away down that road, and frankly, the consequences for the planet would be horrendous indeed.
Thank you. We'll have one last one.
I'm happy to roll with a couple, and I'll keep my answers short because people have been very patient listening to me to drone on. So.
Thank you very much. Mark Lindsay, I also teach here at the Theological School. In thinking about the upcoming Paris meeting, it strikes me that one of the inherent deficiencies is that government representatives will naturally speak out of national interest. But you've also been speaking about the church, and the church is just one of the global religious traditions that, alongside the multinationals, generally speak outside of national boundaries and can therefore take a genuinely more global view than many of the strictly nationalist, national-focused perspectives. So I wonder, at Paris or perhaps beyond, what scope is there for the leaders of the great religious traditions to have a voice into that discussion, because they do speak in a way that's non-parochial?
Well, thank you for the question. Many people engaged in the whole debate about interfaith dialogue and the role of faith in the modern secular age skip over one point, and that is the vast bulk of the world's population are religious believers of one form or another. The vast bulk. Those who profess to be of no religious faith at this stage are in fact a relative minority, small minority, out of the world's 7 billion population. That is principle number one. Principle number two, therefore, if that is so, then it follows that what the leaders of faith traditions say about this ethical question, which in turn becomes a political question, matters. And three, that is why there's a particular priority attached to what Pope Francis has had to say. I was in the United States for the whole period, I now live in New York, for the whole period of his visit. It was not just the classic American rock star reception of, you know, some guy wearing white. It was the fact that he took on the Congress. He was labelled by some as being sort of a socialist or communist pope. It reminds me of Joe Bjelke-Petersen in the old days, and talking about Felix Arnott in Brisbane, for those of you with memories to remember. But as he addressed not just the Congress, but as he addressed the UN General Assembly, which is full of some pretty hard-bitten professional diplomats who speak constantly in national interest terms, there's a palpable impact of the clarity of his moral call. If it was just a moral call in the absence of any groundings of the science, well, it would not have the same effect. But when every government in the world has been subjected to now 27 years of findings from the International Panel of Climate Change Scientists, and you still have this ethical equivocation from some states or some actors within states or within the church, like Cardinal Pell, that, well, we don't know in the end of the day. Frankly, what the world saw with the Pope's statement was a simple proposition which said, you know this is true, and you know it takes political courage to act. Get on with it. And so to see that in play in the United Nations General Assembly, which is not a majority Christian assembly, was in fact, I believe, the Pope speaking to the universality of a disquietening of the conscience of humankind and pointing with hope to an alternative solution for the future.
Josh, I'm actually from Australian Young Labor.
G'day, Matt. How are you? Go on. He's going to rip into me, this bloke.
No, absolutely not. My question goes more into the public policy section, particularly the discussion about government making ethical decisions and how we grapple with that in the current challenges of the time, particularly if we've got vested interest groups and if we look at the situation where the price on carbon was essentially eroded because of those powerful vested interest groups. Then we, of course, have a situation only recently where the Syrian crisis, and we saw a young boy that perished at sea, and the values argument that essentially drove the nation to agree that we need to have a more humanitarian approach to refugees. It seems, though, on issues such as climate change, government and the value-added argument of how to address climate change is not having a material impact as the issue on the case of the Syrian refugee. My question to you is, how does government, in the problems that we face with the unethical approaches by vested interest groups to prevent the sort of progressive reform needed on these issues, particularly around the communication, how do we get a values-based argument from government that is translated to people who might not necessarily be engaged in the political process but agree that there is an important need to address climate change because it affects me personally? It's my value-driven argument. But when it comes to the public policy paradigm of whether or not it costs $100 for a litre of land, that issue is lost in the overall discussion about, you know, the position of the individual. So how do government get to that value proposition that we've been essentially underpins your speech?
I think, I make no particular comment about the current state of the debate in Australia. I've been in the United States for a long period of time, and my general principle is not to engage in the domestic political debate here. So I'll just make two points there. One is, if you're engaged in an exercise which seeks to change public policy, there are, in my view, two general approaches. One is to argue the ethical position, and remember, there are contending ethical positions, as I've argued consistently through my lecture. It is not just the ethical position which says we must act. There's also the conflicting ethical position which says, actually, no, I'd just rather look after myself now and, you know, forget about the future. So entering that ethical debate and having sway within that debate is important. Then there's a second argument, which is practical, and that is to sustain the argument in what I would describe as the rational domain of public policy. What I sought to do tonight is say, number one, here's the science. What's the counter-science, and what is the established global scientific consensus as defined by the International Panel of Climate Change Scientists? That's a objective, rational conclusion. Number two, objective, rational argument. If you therefore act, can you make a difference? Reasonable question. A lot of people say, 2% of the world, 1.5% of the world, And then the reason I bored you all senseless with at least 10 minutes of data about these are the actions taken, but here are the actual consequences in terms of measured climate change impact, is to say there's a practical and rational argument to say that if you do X, it produces Y result. And the third thing is to take on rational grounds the proposition that, you know, if you have a price on carbon, for example, be fearful that you won't be able to afford a leg of lamb next week. And what I've sought to argue again, without being exhaustive about it, is that through this whole process of climate change action, in the middle of a global financial crisis, Australian average incomes actually increased. And so therefore, it is a combination of the above, addressing the ethical, arguing the rational, and bringing these propositions together. A final point is, politics also responds to when communities organise. I remember, for example, lead up to 2007, a bunch of folk in this town, don't mind me calling Melbourne a town, dear, I'm from a city called Brisbane, but it was a joke, don't get offended. There's a bunch of folk down here led by a young fellow called Hugh Evans and Oak Tree, which frankly mobilised a whole bunch of people in this city and then nationally around one simple proposition. How do we get the Australian government, as it then was, to lift ODA to 0.5 of gross national income, overseas development assistance to become 0.5 national income? They just didn't sort of have a lot of hand-holding at Saturday night church meetings. What he did was roll around the country and act as a political activist, making life hard for individual MPs, saying, we, the young people in particular of this community, want this to happen. And they door-knocked each of those MPs and said, if you don't commit to this, we're going to give you lots of trouble. Now, that's fair and legitimate public action. Consequence of that was, though I'd reached a similar decision for other reasons myself, is I was able to carry our party with a proposition that would increase ODA to 0.5, and by the time the government left, we were about 0.367, heading towards 0.4 and rising, and since then I think you know what has happened. So it's a cocktail of the above. Perhaps we should take a last question because everyone's been very patient. Well, both of you get a go. The guy up the front here with the interesting ponytail and the guy back there without the interesting ponytail.
Thanks so much for the lecture. It was really interesting. I suppose what I wanted to touch on was I find that the climate change debate, it's so important. And there's all of these statistics, as you were saying, about the inevitable downturn of, for instance, its impact upon agriculture. And I suppose from a young person's perspective, I think that we need to have that debate for direct action against climate change, but there also needs to be a transition to rhetoric and a debate about adaption to climate change as well, particularly in the agribusiness sector. And I find it quite concerning as a young person that there isn't this level of debate in Australia at the moment where, for instance, wheat yields are meant to be adversely affected by 60% by 2030. And that's not in the too distant future. So I suppose I just wanted to get your commentary on to what extent that should there be a debate about climate action alongside climate adaption in Australia?
Well, the two classical categories for the debate on climate change internationally, and it's not really, as you correctly say, conceived with the same clarity domestically, is between mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation is what I've been talking about. How do you bring down greenhouse gas emissions nationally and globally to the extent that you stabilise at 450 parts per million in order by century's end to keep temperature increases within 2 degrees centigrade? That is an essential debate. To walk away from it is, I think, to take the coward's approach. Adaptation, however, is equally critical. How do we, for example, build resilience for the good people of Kiribati and prepare for their immediate future, the good people of the Maldives and their immediate future, and those who are now climate change vulnerable? And there's been much literature on the impact of climate change and civil disturbances within Darfur, for example, in the Sudan. So my argument is that both these debates have comparable ethical significance. You can't have one without the other. You can't say, sorry, you can sink while I go over here and fix it for 2080. You've got to be equally concerned about these folks here and what you do in practical terms about them. Footnote on wheat, by the way. If you look at the CSIRO reports on climate change, they're quite clear about the implications for Australia longer term. Where I come from in northern Australia, it's going to get a lot wetter, and where you guys come from down here, it's going to get a lot drier in southeastern and southwestern Australia. And so, frankly, that has a radical impact on the way in which both parts of Australia do business. Wheat is big here, and it's big in southwestern New South Wales and obviously in the wheat belt of Western Australia as well. So I go back to arguing the facts which proceed from the science. I say this to almost conclude, one question to go. In the business of politics, fear is an easier emotion to harness than hope. Fear, if you think about it when you were last afraid, physically afraid, when you were last physically afraid, try to think about that. It is an all-encompassing emotion. It's quite paralysing. Hope is less defined in terms of people's emotional experience of it. Fear, we all know. Why are there a million horror movies out there and much less a number about hope? Because it's a very potent emotion. Fear sells, regrettably. So in this debate, we have this dual challenge. That is not to be fear merchants ourselves, because frankly, the fear industry is run against the advocates of climate change action. The economy will collapse, it'll have no effect, or it will impoverish working families by the impact of a carbon price. We have to address this in terms of the ethics of hope, the ethics of practical action, as well as the measurability of what happens if we act and if we don't act. Last chap up the back.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry, you've got a dog collar on. I shouldn't have been so bad to you.
It's all right. Thank you for
being respectful to the members of the clergy here.
My name's Luke. I'm a PhD student here at Trinity. Thank you for one last question, and thank you for your words tonight to us, Mr. Rudd. The question I had is slightly different from perhaps all the others, and if you don't mind, a slightly personal one, perhaps, in asking...
This is where politicians get nervous, but go on.
In your time as a diplomat and as a politician, how has that shaped, changed, affected your own personal understanding of God?
Sorry, just repeat it for me so I get it clearly.
So in your time as a diplomat, as a politician, as an academic, how has your own understanding of God been shaped, changed, affected, and so on? I'll let you answer that any way you wish.
No, that's
a big
fine.
Question.
Yeah. No, I think I've got that. Yeah, you're right. Normally we run a million miles from personal questions. So, in case any of us are ever seen as being vulnerable, which of course by definition we're not. That was a joke, okay? People involved in the political process are just made of flesh and blood. They regularly stuff up. I have. But you get up, dust yourself off and keep going. I'm always reminded of, I think it's the writer to the Hebrews who talks about running the race that is set before us. Bearing in mind he who is the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. That's the Rudd paraphrase of whichever translation you've got. My apologies to the theologians and the biblical scholars who are here. But I think if you reflect on the Christian gospel and the biblical tradition, there is something which is rich there about simple spiritual resilience. Last time I looked, Jesus of Nazareth did not have a smooth ride. It was a bit bumpy. And I look at the history of the apostles. It was a sticky end for most of them. And so I think even when things in the vocation of someone in political life does not turn out as a bed of roses, you become much, much more deeply attached to an enduring reliance on God. It becomes much less theoretical, becomes genuinely a daily thing. When you're dealing with complexities you can't quite get your head around, variables which you can never control, outcomes which to everyone else in the Australian community seem perfectly clear and easy to do by lunchtime the next day, and the challenges of communicating the above and the complexity of public life. So I think people have asked me, for example, how does myself and my family come through our own times in politics, which, as you know, has been a reasonably public affair and reported on. You may have read some of the clippings. I think my answer to that is that had I not a rock of faith upon which to rely, this would have been infinitely more difficult. I admire fundamentally those who proceed with resilience in their professional and public careers in the absence of that. It must be a profound ethical construction upon which they rely. Alternatively, they're just utterly cavalier and don't give a damn. I'm not quite sure. Something about the rock of faith, I think, just becomes somewhat more real. For those of you who have followed a few things I've written before, you cannot look at the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and say, well, yeah, that was all a bed of roses, you know, a few Nazis here or there, not a problem. And if you read Bonhoeffer carefully, I mean, his was not a perfect life. This guy was as failed as the rest of us in some respects. But he had a deep sense of Christian responsibility of duty. And if you read his last writings, not just in Tegel, but when he was sent south to the concentration camps on his way to being executed 2 weeks before the formal end of the war. It's just remarkable. It's not that he didn't experience long dark nights of the soul. He did. You read letters from prison, many long nights. Dark nights of the soul. But this guy had, in his often impenetrable German theological language, sure you guys understand it better than I do, but there's still a simple resilience and a rock of faith. Now, these folk had serious problems to contend with. You know, I've just been in public office for a bit and doing a few other things now, so it's different. But I think for all of us, the question of the resilience which comes from the rock of faith is important.
I'm now going to invite Dr. Philip Dutton from Bergman College to give our special thanks to Kevin.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we won't hear Kevin say to us that he's droned on or bored us senselessly this evening. Just the opposite, I think, embodied in those last two questions from two younger members of the audience, where they began with a genuine thank you themselves. All I can do now is compliment that in a very small way. So, as the principal of Bergman College, the ANU, and the fellow alumnus of Bergman College, it really is a great pleasure to extend a vote of thanks on your behalf to the 2015 Dr. Williams, Rowan Williams QAC lecturer, the Honourable Kevin Rudd. This evening we have had the great fortune to be able to hear directly from someone whose understanding of the great issues before us in this shared world begins and ends with faith. Perhaps faith in each other, as well as faith in the future, faith in ourselves, faith in God. When I first took note of the title of the 2015 lecture, Faith, Ethics and Climate Change, I was immediately reminded, and we were reminded this evening, and many Australians would do so, of Kevin's reference to climate change some years ago now. I think you mentioned 2007, as climate change is the great moral, economic and social challenge of our time. Clearly that has not changed, and we're reminded so strongly of that this evening. The National Climate Change Summit in 2027 and Bali, as our leader of the opposition, was an immediate signing of the Kyoto Protocol in his first days as Prime Minister, then on to the UN Climate Change Conference as our Prime Minister in Copenhagen. And now, on we go to the Climate Change Conference in Paris at the end of the month. A great time to be re-entering or strengthening the debate, as he has proposed to do this evening. And what really a privilege that is for us this evening to be part of that process. This evening we've been urged in the most compelling ways by a man who lives life at full tilt at a public and international level to consider still, at the deepest level, our own values based in faith. A strong compulsion and challenge, not to ignore or to take lightly the future we all share and hope to pass on. And who better worldwide than to do that for us this evening but you, Kevin? And where better than here in the Trinity College dining hall within the University of Melbourne, where students of the highest calibre and potential come together so often on a daily basis to test their own views, ethics, faith, and dare I say, the menu, in the context of hopefully a better future for all of us. On behalf of the Board of Trustees and members of the colleges and universities of the Anglican Communion and all of us assembled here, under the great generosity and hospitality of the staff and students of Trinity, I would like to thank you, Kevin, for your inspiration and most worthy challenge to us all in delivering the 2015 Dr. Rowan Williams Annual QAC Lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join with me once more in giving full weight in your applause to the thanks I know we all share.